Approaching on a 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. On at 15 seconds, guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Grant Cameron, and I've got some ramblings I want to do today. Put together a little PowerPoint of things that have sort of occurred in the last couple of days that I thought would be important to share. I've titled this presentation, Is the Paranormal World the True Reality? I've written a couple of books. One was called Inspired. One was called Contact Modalities, in which I look at the possibility that the more accurate reality is found in paranormal states, that once one gets out of the conscious mind and gets into the field, you can bring back material. And the concept is, as described by UFO experiencers, of which 40% say at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. Or with near-death experience people who said at one point, 31% said at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. The concept is that the information is there in the field, and it's an ability of using a modality to get into the field, get the material, and bring it back. Now, the way it works in ufology is a little bit different. And we basically ignore the people who claim to have been in these matrix reality who have brought this material back. People will say it's anecdotal, it's illusion. The only thing that really counts is what you can measure and what you can see in the physical world. So basically what happens is we end up in a situation where we start going into sightings, and we're into sightings again. We did this in 1947. We've done this umpteen times. And now with the new Senate situation with the money, they are doing it again. We're basically going to look at sightings. But the thing is, we're going to look at sightings which are just military sightings, because the CIA, the intelligence operations, and the military do not have an authority to investigate American citizens. Therefore, they can't investigate their sightings. So all that's going to happen in this new investigation is that they're going to investigate military sightings. They're going to totally ignore experiencers, except for military experiencers and what kind of injury type events they've had. But basically, the experiencers are going to be ignored. And I've actually checked this indirectly through interviews I've done. One of the interviews, I was talking to Chris Bledsoe. Chris Bledsoe has 15,000 videos and photographs. So I said to Chris, I mean, they're doing this new investigation now at Congress. You've got all these, they want photos, they want hard evidence. Have they talked to you about your 15,000 photos and videos? And he said, no, they have not. And again, it comes down to this idea that they do not have authority to go to American citizens and take their material. That's why they're working with military people, because they can access military medical records and things like that, and they are not allowed to spy on American people. So that's cut out. The other one I talked to was Deborah Cobble, who is the subject of the famous book Intruders, written by Bud Hopkins. For people who know, her file was actually, she was being investigated not only by Bud Hopkins, but by John Carpenter. And John Carpenter sold his UFO abduction files to Bob Bigelow, which created a huge controversy because it was confidential material, medical material. It all went to Bob Bigelow. He bought this material up, created this huge controversy. So I asked Deborah Cobble, I mean, they've got your file, and Bob Bigelow ran the OSAP program. He was the main contractor for it. I said, did they talk to you about your experience? Because they've got your file and they claim they want to get this material. And she said, no, they haven't talked to me. And I would venture to guess that they have not talked to any American citizens for these reasons, that you can't really talk to civilians. So we're in this situation where we're just going to go and reinvestigate UFO sightings. And I show one UFO sighting here. This is material that I just recently got through an access to information request in Canada. There was a story that came out that said that the Canadian government was feeding UFO reports to the UFO community. And of course, I wanted to check that. So I filed this access to information. There was a number of agencies that were involved. Transport Canada, this is a Transport Canada document. And the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the military were all collecting these cases, then claimed they weren't collecting cases, they had no interest in this, but apparently we're still collecting cases and we're sending them to an investigator in Winnipeg. So I filed the access to information request for all the correspondence that they've done with this researcher, with other Canadian researchers, with Lou Elizondo. Who are they actually talking to? What's actually going on? They brought back nothing except 160 pages of UFO sighting material. So here's one of them. I'll give you an example. Here's the summary description. NORAD advised that they observed an unidentified target between FL-330 and FL-350 moving southwest at 75 knots. No impact to operation. There were no aircraft involved. There were no vehicles involved. That's a sighting report. And this is what we're going to use to investigate what's actually going on. This, to me, and I've said this since probably 1976, is a total waste of time. Here's another one that they sent. Summary description, ground observer called, I guess it would be Winnipeg shift manager to report four orange colored unidentified light slowly moving northwest, approximately 4 nautical miles north of Winnipeg Airport. No known aircraft in vicinity. Service report filed with North Bay. Again, what you're going to learn out of that is simply nothing other than the fact that something weird is going on. You're not going to determine anything from these kind of reports. Here's a third one that I have. And as I said, I've got 160 pages of this stuff. I didn't even read it. I only pulled a couple for this because it's all basically the same thing. I think this is the one where they scrambled. No, this is just another report. An object green in color, shaped like a jelly bean, 3 feet in diameter. Pilot stated that it was not a balloon and that if it were a balloon, it would be going in the same direction. So this is what we're gathering, the UFO sighting. I maintain that you have to talk to the experiencers. And I maintain that once you start talking to the experiencers, you start to learn what's actually going on in some very important material. This is what I'm going to show you today. I've got a book coming out called The UFO Sky Pilots. And for whatever reason, I seem to be targeted with people who claim that they have flown the flying saucer. In this book, I have 36 witnesses. And there are very few others other than the material I've got. And they basically all tell basically the same story. When you start looking at these reports, you would say, I mean, if you're going to be making up a story or having an illusion about being on a flying saucer, the last thing you want to put on your UFO report to a UFO investigator is the fact that you claimed that you flew the flying saucer. As Jacques Vallée would say, this is absurd. This makes no sense whatsoever. This is not something you're going to put in your report. And yet these people are all basically reporting it. And when you start looking at this, you see that there is very important stuff starts to come out of this. One of the things is you have this whole idea that's talked about non-locality, but Einstein called spooky action at distance, this idea that if you have two entangled particles, you have one going in one direction at speed of light, one going in the other direction. One can be on one side of the galaxy. One can be on the other side of the galaxy. When you change the spin of the one object, the other one will instantaneously change. And this is this idea of non-locality, which starts to look at the idea, is there really time and space? Or is there a particle that is actually moving faster than time and space, which actually signals its buddy on the other side of the universe? So there's been lots of debates about this, whether this exists or whether this, what this really means. And you start looking at the reports of the people who've flown the craft and you start to see this same non-locality. So people say, well, we can do it with a few particles. We can teleport, small little tiny atomic structures. We can do particles, electrons, photons, this sort of thing. But when you get to the big world, they'll say, no, this doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in the big world. Well, the indications from the people who fly the craft is, yeah, you can do this in the big world as well. And that would indicate that we have something to learn from this, that you can actually learn rather than looking at these UFO sightings, which basically are just lights flying around in the sky. Here is a report. This is comes from Dr. Scott Jones. Now, Dr. Scott Jones was one of the Avery. At one point, people believed he was the Falcon. And I remember I used to talk to him about this. So there was a bunch of people back in the 80s, and I was pointing these people out. I think I may have been the first person to actually list the Avery, the people. And I said, watch these people. They're very important. They have material that the average person doesn't have. They're working on this. And these would be former military and people, intelligence people, scientists like Hal Puthoff and Kit Green and all these people who worked on these various programs. And they, like the rest of us, are just trying to figure this thing out. And they talked among themselves and they would exchange material. And from time to time, some of that material would leak into the UFO field as to what they were learning at whatever level, what people were telling them, because they had better access than you and I. And I always said, you should watch these Avery people. Whatever you want to think about them, you should watch them. One of them was Dr. Scott Jones, who was an advisor. He was an aide to Senator Claiborne Pell. Senator Claiborne Pell was the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. He was one of the most powerful senators there was. He was very interested in UFOs. He was also very interested in paranormal phenomena. Well, Scott Jones had the wonderful job of actually just working for him, going to UFO conferences, going to mediums, going to all sorts of weird things and reporting back to Claiborne Pell. If you don't believe that, you can actually go to the Rhode Island University where I was, and I actually looked at the files. All the files of the reports that Scott Jones made to Claiborne Pell are in a huge file there, and all sorts of weird stuff that he was discovering. He went to China. He went to Russia. He tried to recover a piece of alien tissue from the Russians. He told me the story that he had been to China, and in China, he had asked the Chinese officials what they knew. And in China, everybody works for the government. It's all one unified organization. Whereas in the United States, you have the Senate is separate from the House, and that's separate. There's all these different branches of government. And he kept saying, no, I'm just an aide to Claiborne Pell. And of course, the Chinese, of course, did not believe that. They figured, well, you got to be working for the president. You got to be the guy. And so they basically were telling him stuff. And he said to them, why don't you release? Why don't you disclose before the Americans? And he told this famous story to me. He said, the Chinese told him, when the Americans disclose, will be a close second. So Claiborne Pell and Scott Jones were working on all this kind of stuff. And Scott Jones is still alive. He was very much into remote viewing. And he was also very famous. He was with Rockefeller. And this is this quote I want to show here. He was with Lawrence Rockefeller when Rockefeller went to the Clinton White House to get disclosure from the president of the United States. And they gave a briefing to Dr. Jack Gibbons, who was a science advisor to President Clinton in March of 1993, just after Bill Clinton came to office. And they wanted this stuff released. So in this is one of the things from 1,000 pages of material that I recovered from that initiative from the Clinton Library. And well, actually, this is not in the Clinton Library. It's missing from the Clinton Library. I got it from the Clinton administration before they left, from the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But all that material, when I went to the Clinton Library, is missing. The 1,000 pages of Rockefeller Initiative documents, which Steve Bassett has a copy, and I gave my other copy of the documents to Joe Bookman in Utah. They have the actual documents. Even though I sent the actual index of the documents and names and stuff, the Clinton Library claimed they don't have them. I went to the National Archives. They said they didn't have them. And when I filed an appeal, I lost the appeal, and that's where it stands. These documents don't exist. But this is a memo that was written from Scott Jones to Jack Gibbons. And he mentions the fact, he says, my mention of mind control at the February 4th meeting was quite deliberate. please be careful about this. There are reasons to believe that some government group has interwoven research about this technology with alleged UFO phenomena. If that is correct, you can expect to run into early resistance when inquiring about UFOs. Not because of the UFO subject, but because that has been used to cloak research and applications of mind control activity. And I've maintained this numerous times that the Canadians knew already in September of 1950 that there was a mental connection to this UFO phenomena. And I always maintain that that was one of the key things they were looking at, not so much the propulsion of the technology, but this whole mind control thing, this not mind control, but the idea that consciousness may be primary, that consciousness may be what this is all about. And I also, when I had my consciousness download, the other material that was given to me was the fact that Dr. Eric Walker, who knew what was going on, had told us, what do you know about ESP? Unless you understand about ESP and how it works, you will not be taken in by the control group. Very few people understand how this works. He indicated, and then, of course, Ben Rich indicated in 1993 to Jan Harzen at UCLA at a lecture that ESP was how it worked. That's how they got here. That's how the whole thing works. So this mind control, this mind connection is extremely important. And that's what you see when you start talking to experiencers. And that's what I want to sort of detail a little bit today. I'm going to relate some stories of some of the sky pilots and what they say about this. And I tie it in, as I say, when you start looking at UFOs, you have to look across the spectrum. There is all sorts of stuff. It's all together. It's all one thing. Paranormal phenomena is all connected with UFOs. It's all the same thing, especially if consciousness is primary. Ingrid Honkala, who I'm trying to get an interview with, is a biological oceanographer who has worked for NASA and for the Navy, and had a near-death experience when she was almost 3 years old in Colombia. And this is what she reported in her near-death experience. Whenever I put my mind, I could go. Wherever I put my mind, I could go. Time and space had vanished for me. I could be anywhere at any time. She refers to the fact that she saw a dog at the end of the street, and she was instantly with the dog. She saw a park bench at the end of the park at the end of the street, and she was instantly at the park. She saw a tree and was instantly at the tree. She thought of her housekeeper that was in the house. She was instantly in the room with the housekeeper. Then she thought about her mother, and she was instantly with her mother. And this is this idea that whatever she thought, whatever came into her mind, she could instantly be there. And this is extremely important because this is exactly what the sky pilots talk about as well. This idea that there may be this ability to move around, and that time and space may not exist. As Ingrid talked about, it was as if time and space has vanished. So the question is, if time and space really don't exist, then how big is the universe? And the question arises, are there actually planets out there in space, way out, far away, or is it all a singularity? Is it all one thing? When you start looking at UFO experiencers and you talk about OBE experiencers and near-death experiences, you'll hear this thing that people are going within. They're not going anywhere. And this is this concept that we just have something wrong. We've made assumptions which actually aren't right. We've got a conditioned mind that has told us it's this and that. It's very hard to get these ideas out of our head. Here's one of the ones which sort of symbolizes that. L.V. Ray Smith was one of the co-developers of Pixel and the studios and the cartoons. They did the first three animated movie. And he talks about the whole idea about Pixar was the company that they developed. But Pixel, he talks about Pixel. And he spends a lot of time in this book talking about a pixel. He said, what is a pixel? Now, people will say, well, a pixel is when you take a picture and you make it bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you get down to the point where you see the pixels. And this is a idea where you've got all these pixels, and L.V. Ray said, this is almost impossible to try to tell people this is not what a pixel is. This is not a pixel. And he describes it as a repackaging of infinity, which is subtle and beautiful. A pixel is a one-dimensional object. It is invisible. And what they do, and this is a strange part, is what they have done, and this is how we've got now digital photographs and stuff like that, is what they did is they use Fourier transform mathematics. And what they did is they take the one-dimensional pixel and they spread it. They're called spreaders. And the more powerful the computers get, the more powerful the photographs they can get, because they can spread more pixels. So what they do is they take this one-dimensional object and they spread it into a two-dimensional object, and then they form them into these boxes. But a pixel is invisible. It's a one-dimensional object and you can't see it. And everybody just assumes that it's these little boxes. The interesting thing about this is that Fourier transform mathematics, which is used for pixel, was also used by Denis Gabor. So Denis Gabor actually invented the hologram. And he had this whole thing with the Fourier transform mathematics. And the other one that we used, it was Carl Pribram. Now, Carl Pribram, you see him here with Jim Semivan. Carl Pribram was the guy that realized that Gabor had come up with the idea of the hologram and won the Nobel Prize in 1971 for it. And Pribram came up with the idea of the holographic brain, because he realized that the brain was using the same Fourier transform mathematics. So this is this interesting connection where all these things are all tied together, and we're making assumptions, and underlying that, the world may be like a giant hologram and like a virtual reality thing. And we're just assuming, because we've got this conditioned mind that we can't change, that it works like solid nuts and bolts, and you can measure and stuff, and all the rest of it is illusion. Now, here's Stephen Greer, who's taken a lot of static, but he sure got it right on this one. Here he talks about this idea that everything is inside. The entirety of creation is folded within each individual. We are truly a quantum hologram of the whole creation. When the Sufis say, "Thinkest thyself a puny form when within thee the universe is folded." A rhetorical question being asked, which illuminates a profound truth. All is folded within the awake mind within. This is a new concept that may take decades or centuries to get across, but this is this idea that everything is, as Deepak Chopra would say, everything is an activity inside consciousness. It's all Maya. I actually wrote the book called Managing Magic, which talked about the UFO disclosure thing from the US government. And there was actually some feedback. I sort of got some feedback that high-level people had sort of picked up on this managing magic idea. And the idea that I had was that it's not just UFOs, it's remote viewing, it's psychic phenomena, and that they realize all this stuff is tied together. So it's not that they're investigating UFOs, they're investigating magic, all this kind of stuff. And when you look at magic, the Sanskrit word for magic is Maya, the concept of Maya, the illusion. It's all illusion. It's all uli stuff, as one quantum physicist said. Greer goes on to say, and by going into a state of consciousness that is non-local, that is a transcendent state of awakeness, every point in space and time can be accessed. So this is this whole concept that Ingrid was talking about, this idea that there was no time and space, that whatever she thought is what is where she went. And you see this tie-in between her out-of-body experience and what people describe in these states where they claim they're flying the flying saucer. Here's Ron Johnson, who is a critical example of this non-locality thing. This is his being, his name is LB, and he said that LB had been with him, showed him all sorts of stuff, and at one point he was allowed to fly the craft, and he LB asked him, where did he want to go? So here's his accounting of that flying of the craft. "Wow, we were just sitting there, and I was watching. It was awesome. I asked him, I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, it's all inside you. All you have to do is think, and the ship will respond to whatever you want to do. It's all inside you. I said, I'd like to go out into deep space and see the Milky Way galaxy from a distance. It only took maybe a second or so. And all of a sudden, we had come to a stop way out in space somewhere, and I'm looking at the Milky Way galaxy. Now, Ron Johnson is a practicing Mormon. He's not the type of guy who's going to make up a story. And more importantly, his story agrees with all the other stories. They're telling this same story. So if he goes in for 1 second from here to outside the Milky Way looking back, that's got to be faster than the speed of light, which indicates it's like this non-local particle, and you can do it at higher levels. Here's Chris Bledsoe, my friend Chris Bledsoe, who, when I found out he had flown the craft, I said to him, I need to know how you've done it. And he basically described the same thing. He said, whatever, he put his hand on a beehive that was on a column in the middle of the craft. And he, whatever he thought, he became one with the craft was alive, the screen opened up, and whatever he thought is what the ship did. So he basically tells exactly the same story from his experience dealing with the craft. Now, here's where you see the crossovers between the two. So Ingrid talks about the fact that when she saw the dog, she really liked animals. She saw the dog, she was instantly with the dog. And Chris described it this way. He said, the way it works is you see a cloud and you decide, oh, I'd like to go to that cloud. The cloud is instantly there. It's the same, exactly the same story that Ingrid is telling. You see the cloud and suddenly the cloud is there. It's like the cloud comes to you instantaneously. All you got to do is think, I want to go to that cloud, and it's there. So you see these crossovers between near-death experiences and UFO experiences, which the question comes down to, is the abduction experience a near-death experience, or is the near-death experience an abduction experience, or are they both happening in the same matrix environment? It's just a place where you can access, and the same rules apply, which aren't the same rules that apply here on the physical earth. Another thing that they connected, and there's a lot of the number one being that is seen, according to the free survey of 3,000 or 4,000 experiences, whatever they did, basically talks about the energy being is the number one being that is seen. Well, both Chris saw the energy being, and Ingrid has seen the beings as well, like Ingrid Hunkela. She actually is in contact with these beings all the time. And you got to remember, she has this very sort of job with high security clearances and stuff. And she talks about this interaction, and Chris talks about these beings of light. And she said they actually just sort of take a form. Now, this is from the movie Cocoon, which indicates that the movie Cocoon may have had some inside idea about how this stuff works. And there's a movie from many, many years ago that our essence is actually a ball of light. And Ingrid said they actually were a ball of light. And then when she couldn't really figure it out and come to grips with it, they actually started to make a human form. But they only did that to accommodate her, to understand that she was talking to somebody, that they were real beings. When we get other beings, there's a documentary. I'm going to be doing an interview with two women out of England, out of London, who are in contact with what are called the beings. And the beings, I actually had a conversation with them. It was either me or someone else, but this is what basically was said. The question was asked, are you actually extraterrestrials? Now, these beings have no faces. They have no ears, no nothing. And there's three of them. They always come. They don't come as individuals. They come as a collective. There's three of them. And what they said to, whether it was my question or someone's question, was, are you actually extraterrestrials? And what they said is, oh, if you want us to be extraterrestrials, we can be extraterrestrials. We can even take you to our planet if you want. But no, we have always been here. You're the visitor. And this is the same concept, that it may all be here and now. There's nothing out anywhere. They are actually here. They said, we've always been here. And you see this over and over again with people who are asked the beings. They'll talk about this thing you wouldn't understand, where we're from, all this kind of stuff. Or they'll say, we're actually from here. We aren't from anywhere. UC Ronan, here's the book that he wrote, which is the number one message that the beings are trying to put across is this oneness message. When I had the interview with him, he had asked the beings about where they're from and all this kind of stuff and why they look like they do. And his were these green beings. Here's what the being said to him. And I quote this all the time on my email, because I think it's so important as to what they told him. They said, the way you see us is defined by you. When we visit your world, we temporarily have a physical body defined in a certain way, but it is not the only form or our original essence. In our dimension, there is no need for a physical body defined in a particular way as in yours. You share the definitions of reality that are given to you, but you are not yet aware of it. And so this is the whole idea that they can come and they can appear, they can come into the physical world and appear as whatever they want to appear as, but that's not their original essence. They're like the energy beings. And this is one of the key messages in all mystical literature, all UFO literature, is this idea: remember who you actually are. You are not the actor on the stage. You are playing an actor on the stage. You are off the stage. You are an energy being that comes in and plays various roles and goes back in and becomes, but your original essence is not this, the actor on the stage. Kit Green, who's doing the investigation of experiencers who have been injured, the military, talked about this is the closest that the government has come to talking to experiencers and trying to figure out what they do. And this is what he said: if the witness was inclined to believe in extraterrestrials, then that is what he or she would see and would experience. In reality, what the witnesses were actually viewing was nothing like the different interpretations that existed in each of their minds. And again, it can appear different to each of the witnesses present at the same event. We are part of what we're seeing, which comes to this idea where I always talk about the beings. Why do everybody, all the descriptions I've seen of greys, they're all completely different. They're people think they're all the same. They're not. So why are some people seeing greys, and why are some people seeing, you know, beautiful beings with long hair and this sort of stuff? People are seeing different beings, and what kind of beings you see depends upon what the age is. So we go back before 1961. I'll maintain there was no written material on reptilians before 1988. There was no written material on greys before 1961. If you look at all the contact reports before 1961, this is what you see: wearing a diver's suit, helmets with a faceplate, almost like old 1940 cartoons. Wore a one-piece shiny metallic suit with a round glass-like helmet. I mean, that's right out of the 1940 cartoon stuff, comic books. White helmets, wore shiny helmets. A man of average sight with a helmet. Handsome men, translucent helmets. A short humanoid with round, shiny helmet. This is the kind of reports you got before 1961. Completely different reports. After 1961, the helmets go away. There are no more aliens. There are no aliens running around now with helmets. The same as in the 1960s and maybe even in the 1970s, there was UFOs, or especially in the 50s, there was UFOs with windows in them. Very few UFOs have windows in them anymore. They don't look that way. In fact, a lot of UFO stuff now is indirect, is orbs, it's this kind of stuff. Jean Kimura was another one. She and another woman were taken. They were at Sedona camping. There was three women in a tent. Two of them were taken. They were on board the ship, and she describes exactly the same thing with the being that she was dealing with, where they were allowed to fly the ship. And she said, "Well, what do we do?" And he said, "It's in your mind. Imagine where you want to go. That's what you got to do. Imagine it in your mind, push the button, and you will go there." And she said they went boom, boom, boom. And that's how it worked. She said all she had to do was think about it. And the other woman was doing the same thing. And they were totally floored by this fact that they could go anywhere instantaneously, but it had to be within. They had to go within their mind to understand where they wanted to go. That's the only thing they had to do. David is another one. He's to give you an idea, this is not just a bunch of people off the street. David was an F-16 combat pilot out of Iraq. I was speaking at Orange County MUFON. David did not come to the lecture, but he came after. We were having the dinner at the restaurant after, and he came in and someone said, David, you should have been there. Grant was talking about flying the craft. He's talking about people flying the craft. Tell him your story. And then I turned around and I said to him, I said, "Do you fly craft?" And he said, "Well, yeah, but it was a dream." I said, "Well, everybody thinks it's a dream. Tell me, what was it?" And then somebody said, "Hey, David, tell me you're a pilot." And my son's a pilot. My father was a pilot. So I said, "Well, what do you fly?" So he was telling me all the stuff. And once he said he was flying F-16s, then I said, "You have F-16s?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm a retired U.S. Air Force colonel." And I said, "Sit down. Tell me your story. Tell me your dream." And he sat down. And he told me exactly the same story as everybody else said. put your hands on this panel. They tell you, go ahead and do it. You know, and you said, I don't know what to do. You know what to do. Just do it. Put his hands on the panel. He becomes one with the craft. And the craft is alive. Whatever he thinks is what the craft does. And he talked about the fact that he had both hands on this panel. And then he took the one hand up and he thought it was going to stall. And then he lifted the other hand up just a couple inches off the panel. He was ready to slam it back down in case the craft stalled. And he had both hands off the panel and he was flying the craft. This is an F-16 retired U.S. Air Force colonel telling me this story. So it's not people just off the street. Just like Joe. Joe was flying for United Airlines. He was a 747-400 pilot when he retired, and he had two, and he describes them clearly as dreams. He told them to Joe Burks, and Joe told me the story. I interviewed Joe about this, and he said, yes, he had these dreams about a year apart, and both of them were the same thing, where he was flying the craft, and he was part of Mission Rama. He had done a bunch of stuff at Mount Shasta, was very much into not so much the UFO thing, but the Mission Rama, the protocols that they use and stuff like that for making contact. And he had these two very similar experiences where he is flying the craft, described the same thing. The craft's alive wherever you want to go. The craft, it's a mental connection to the brain. He said, it's right there. You don't have to really do anything. All you do is think, and the craft goes according to what you want. Now, my final slide is, again, this idea of non-locality, where we're assuming that there's stuff out there and we've got to get this propulsion and pass the speed of light and all this kind of stuff. This is Sixto Paz, who is one of the two brothers who started Mission Rama back in 1974, just before I had my sighting. And they talk about the Zendras. And I've done a lot of work, and a lot of intelligence people wanted to come and watch this Mission Rama thing going on. They wanted to get this idea of Zendras, indicating that they knew something about this idea of how you move through time and space. And in the Zendra, there's a couple of stories told by various people from Mission Rama, that when this Zendra, and it's like a three-dimensional interface, like a portal that opens up, the beings open it up. And Sixto Paz talks about going in to the Zendra, and as soon as you cross through, you're on another planet. It's like stepping through a doorway onto another planet, which comes down to my final statement, I guess, would be Ron Pandolfi, who was one of his people who was helping him to come to Mount Shasta and to explore this thing with whether a Zendra would open up or not. And he had at one point, it was on camera on a cruise ship going through the Panama Canal. And they asked him, Footman, that was his sort of a code name that they gave him. Footman, what do you say? And he said, people have always wondered what it's like to go into the next world. He said, soon, the next time John, who was sitting right beside him, his friend that he'd gone to university with, next time John goes to the desert, a number of us here will go into the next world and come back again. And this is this idea that you can walk through no time, no space, move from place to place instantaneously. And this is all being told by the experiencers. They're telling these stories. This is where we're going to learn something about how this actually works. And it'll give us a lot farther along the road than using UFO sightings, which, as I said before, actually only do one thing. And that is they put us in a position where we start to understand that something is going on, but you've got to talk to the experiencers. They're the ones that have the real understanding of, are being told how this thing actually works. So thanks for listening, and we'll do another one down the road.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.